This is No Direction's PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage. PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage was made possible thanks to the support of the Roll for Combat podcast, as well as the dedication of our team of volunteers. Due to possibly questionable language, this panel is rated Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Hi, everybody.
Secrets of the Fact World.
Hang on, I gotta start straight.
I'm Rob McCrary, the creative director for Starfinder.
I am Amanda Hammond, who's a managing developer for Starfinder.
I'm Owen Casey Stevens, I'm the Starfinder design lead.
So we're here to talk about the Fact World, but not just the Fact World. So, how many people here are familiar with the Fact World and Starfinder? Hey, I figured that. So
I'm saving a lot of time.
If you're not, the Fact World is sort of the core of our setting. That's the core solar system. Of course, there's a whole galaxy to play around with, so we don't only have to talk about the Pact Worlds today, we can talk about really anything in the setting for the Starfinder game. But I think most of this, unless anybody has anything they want to say right off the bat, we can take questions or...
I do want to make sure that we leak at least one secret, so I came up with one that we can actually give people that hopefully won't ruin anything.
Right at the front? Or
yes, right at the front. Right, so that we have covered a secret of the Pact Worlds. So here's the one secret of the Pact Worlds that I set up in advance that shouldn't ruin anything. When we were designing the setting, we did not originally call it the Pact Worlds. We were calling it the Galarian System, because that's what it's called in Pathfinder. We kept saying Galarian System, Galarian System, Galarian System. And one day someone said, would they really still call it the Galarian System with Galarian gone? Isn't that sort of like, you know, it's a grilled cheese sandwich, but there's no cheese, so isn't that just toast at this point? And so at that point we sat down and we came up with what are we going to call the system, and that actually led to some of the political stuff that came along. We came up with the name. We already knew there was going to be an alliance, but the fact that it was the Epsilon Pact, and therefore the Pact Worlds, and that gave us a name for the setting that doesn't reference the one part of it that isn't there. So there you go. That is one secret of the Pact Worlds. I will now get a new secret ready for next year.
All right. How about maybe we can start with, like, Amanda, do you have a favorite part of the setting that you particularly like?
Well, I'm partial to Triaxis, and it's totally not because I wrote that chapter of the Pact World. But no, I really do enjoy Triaxis, and think that it's really cool. It has a very nice sort of middle ground between the old sort of sword and sorcery, dragon-infested sort of fantasy world, and updating that into a science fantasy far future setting. There's a lot of really interesting sort of plot threads that pull from things that existed in canon and sort of have been updated to take a look at what it looks like now. So I very much enjoy it for you.
How about you, Owen?
Probably my favorite part is Eox, and it's totally not because I got to write it. I am fascinated by the political realities of having what is generally considered to be a giant black festering pot of evil that is an ally, and even an important ally to the rest of the Pact Worlds. That is one of the reasons why we have little notes like Eox were the first political party to sign the Absalom Pact, and that they were crucial in first fighting off the Vesk and then later fighting off the Swarm when those things happened. So that we've got this basis for, yes, a lot of people don't trust them and affect their groups in the Pact Worlds who are actively trying to destroy them. But from a pragmatic point of view, from a real politic look at it, they are an important part of the total force that the Pact Worlds has. And as long as they keep their evil limited to their own planet, they're not really impacting the rest of the Pact Worlds, though that mistrust is perhaps earned. What about you, Rob? You got a favorite part of the Pact Worlds?
Well, I'm going to go outside of the Pact Worlds for the setting in general. And for me, that would be the Aslanti Star Empire, and it's not because I wrote about them.
But that's an awful coincidence.
I think it's all coincidental with all three of us. But, you know, they've got cool green armor, and it was, they're the evil space empire, and they're from Aslan. So there's a cool little connection back to Pathfinder and everything. And, yeah, they're mysterious and bad guys, so they're cool.
And to be entirely honest, in fact, these are not our favorite things because we got to write about them. We wrote about them because they're amongst our favorite things, right? Writing exceptions is a long, involved process, and we usually open with, who's a big fan of this section's going to take a lot of work? And so usually we get people who are already excited to write it. Then, of course, you get to try and interject the parts of that you find really interesting. That helps. make it a vibrant, varied world where each of us are taking our take on one section of it, instead of having one person write everything, which can become a little uniform and only have one worldview.
We should also say that we're not going to give away like every single secret of the setting here. So if you're asking like what caused the gap or who is responsible for that, we probably won't go into that because that is sort of one of the core secrets of the setting. But there's lots of other stuff we can talk about. So
does that imply that you have a reason for the gap, or is that left up to us to develop that as our own
reason for the gap?
There is certainly a narrative reason. There's a meta reason as well, because we do share a setting with Pathfinder, and we didn't want there to be kind of thing that's like, oh well, if I have my character in the future, then he would know what happened in this adventure path, or you know, that kind of stuff. So by putting this sort of enforced period of universe-wide amnesia, really, it kind of separates that. It also helps us narratively to kind of say, okay, everyone's out in space and everything, but it's been relatively recently that people have you know, actually been exploring and contacting, and at least remembering it.
One of the important functions of the gap within the game is it can be a little daunting for someone who comes to Pathfinder as a new player to be told, here is 10,000 years of history for the planet, and that's what we have recorded. That's a lot to take in. And if we then added a few thousand more, which is relevant, and people are trying to figure out, well, who are the first people to have rockets, who are the first people, that's a lot to take in. With the gap, we can say, look, a whole bunch of development happened, and we all know it happens, but our timeline is only a few hundred years. That's all you have to worry about. The rest of that deep continuity happened and largely isn't relevant anymore. So in that regard, it's very useful. We have had conversations about, within the game setting, where did Galarian go? What happened to the gap? Why does no one know what's going on? Why is Torak the one god who's missing? So those are not mysteries to us, but if we came up with a better idea later, we would, of course, be free to vary these things, but we do want to have a baseline of when we are writing up history, what's going on, and what's happening. We have an idea what's happened so that everything remains consistent to that, even if it's not something we're necessarily ever going to publish.
Any other questions? Hopefully somebody has a question.
Right. I'm very interested in the Vesk and the Vescarium. Is there going to be a setting book on the Vescarium plan for the future?
Everybody looked at me.
That's because you're a creative director.
That's true. I would definitely like to. There was discussion about whether to include the Vescarium in the Pack Worlds book, and the argument went out. It's like, well, it's not really part of the Pack Worlds. Although, since it is a core race, the Vesk are a core race, leads me very strongly to think that at some point there will be a book dealing with the Vescarium. Hopefully before too long, because yeah, I mean it is one of our core races that doesn't really have their home detailed yet.
Right. Well, then to follow up, if I can jump in again, is the Vescarium meant to be limited to its one system of planets, like the Pack World, or is it sort of a galaxy-spanning empire, more like the Atlantis Star Empire?
It's another
ambiguous, or is that still something that's?
It's a solar system. It's been in the core rulebook. It's talked about as a solar system. Now they have some. We've also talked about some colonies that the Vescarium has made. So in the same way that Pack Worlds has colonies outside of the system, the Galarian system, but it's not really so much of the big spanning empire like the Atlantis or Empire is, for example.
And actually, as a follow up to a book about the Vescarium, is there going to be a book about? Or that involves the Asante Star Empire, or is that going to be more adventure path back matter material?
Certainly the first place that it's going to be is in the back matter of the Against the Aeon Throne adventure path, which is our next adventure path. So that's going to be the first place where we do that. I would like to keep expanding the setting. You know, if you think about it, I've always described the setting as being sort of like a bullseye. Even though it's not quite geographically that way, you have the Pact Worlds in the center, then you go into near space, and then you have the Vast. Well, the Vescarium happens to be located in near space, the Aslanti Star Empire happens to be located in the Vast. That, again, leads me to think that those are books that we could do to talk about all of those things. And with both the Vescarium and the Aslanti Star Empire, those are kind of the two of the biggest things we've talked about in those two regions.
Continuing on with the Aslanti Star Empire. I'm sorry. Sorry if I'm boring you.
No.
I'm actually running a home game right now where the players are going up against a plot by the Aslanti to infiltrate and take over the Pack Worlds from the inside. And I would like to get a sense of how the Aslanti... I know that they're kind of presented as fascist, but can you give us anything more about how they operate, what their worldview is like? Are they just super arrogant?
They are super arrogant. I mean, that they're not nice people, I guess you could say. I mean, it's kind of like if you're familiar with Pathfinder's history, and I don't want to monopolize whole things, so if somebody wants to throw in here too, but you had sort of Thassilon came out of Aslan and kind of went in a bad direction, and then you have the Star Empire that also kind of went in a bad direction, and I think that because they were kind of by themselves out in this vast universe of hostile species, they're very humanocentric, which to them, because they were the only humans there, meant Aslanti. And I thought that was sort of an interesting thing to play with when you look at the humans of Galarian. You know, it's that's to an Aslanti, they're so far removed from Galarian, even more than the people of the Pact Worlds, that they don't even see themselves as human, or the people of the Pact Worlds may not be human in the same way that they are.
As a follow-up, do they still have purple eyes?
Some of them certainly do, yes.
The other thing about these Landy Star Empires is that their internal narrative is one of victory under adversity, right? So they took this trip way, way, way long ago, pre-GAP, and were an outpost of an empire, and the rest of the empire collapsed, and they have grown from what was probably originally a single expedition to a multi-planetary empire. And they have done that because they had advantages of magic and drive and technology. So they tell themselves, well, we are in this position because we're better than everybody else. That informs a lot of how they approach everything. Of course we're in charge. Of course we have the largest empire. Of course anyone that goes up against us is going to fail. Of course even our allies are second-class citizens or acknowledged alien sentient species, right? They're not Aslanti. We're Aslanti, and everyone else is allowed to operate within our sphere. And I think that gives you a pretty good idea of how they approach things and what their worldview is.
It's also important to point out, too, that the Aslanti Star Empire started because they went to their planet through magical portals from Aslan. Those portals closed. They lost all contact with Galarian and Aslan. And for all they knew, Galarian could have been destroyed back then. And now... You know, you've got thousands of years of their own history where they've created their own history completely cut off from the rest of what they had come from. So they really are like a separate thing, and that's why when there's these first contact with the Pact Worlds, they destroyed all the ships and everything. Why is that? Maybe it's because they don't want to be faced with the fact that there's other people, or, you know, but there's lots of different reasons, but it's, they've kind of built their own thing, and that's what they are, I guess, is a...
Is there any plan to go back to the Ili and the Paste?
What's the date on?
You want to leave it?
Go ahead, go for it.
So, the Ili as the Ili, no, not particularly. We like what we did with the Paste, and I'm not saying that because I got to write it. however, if you look at the Astrozoans in Pact Worlds, it says, on a hunch, a team of researchers recently compared the DNA of an Astrozoan volunteer to samples from an ancient race known as the Ili, who vanished from their home on Apostate during the Gap, and found remarkable numbers of similarities. The Ili were known for being unique, no two of them looked alike, and Astrozoans are our race of shapeshifters. So, that story hasn't ended, but it has taken, as things frequently do, it has taken an unexpected turn and is going in a different direction. So the Ili, as Astrozoans, are still around. They're just in a different place doing a different thing, and even they aren't necessarily aware of how they got from point A, which is where people saw them in Pathfinder, to where they are now. So that is a story that we have begun to tell, and we certainly could pick up and do more with. It's just going to be framed in this framework, that the Astrozoans, our shape changers, who have been hiding in plain sight since the end of the Gap, are how we are now telling the story of the Ili, and will frame any further stories we care to tell about them.
So I don't think you'll see the Ili appear as being called the Ili in anything anytime soon.
That's one of the interesting things, I think, with working on the setting for Starfinder is because the core of that came from distant worlds for Pathfinder, where we first described these planets. And so one of the things that was both fun and challenging is looking, what do we want to pick up and bring forward into Starfinder? What do we want to sort of keep as a Pathfinder thing? And what sort of things do we want to change? You know, and so you have Triaxis is pretty much very similar to the way, you know, the Dragon Riders of the Skyfire Mandate became the Skyfire Legion in Starfinder. The Aili became the Astrazoans. We have Aslan, the Atlantic Star Empire, but there's other things we left behind to keep to be Pathfinder stories. You know, so you can still, people who still want to go in onto the planets in Pathfinder can still do that. And even if we've done something in Starfinder, the gap can kind of, you know, cover that. When, what happened and when did it change?
When the gap ends, there are drow and apostate. For a lot of people that didn't even know drow existed, because that was not common knowledge in Pathfinder, that there were drow. That was something of a shock. But since that's how things started at the end of the gap, no one's sure how they got there, what their plan was, why they set up shop, were they involved with the Illy no longer being there. We might or might not want to tell those stories, but that means that we do now have the opportunity to have stories that involve everyone's reaction to their drow instead of just being a secret that just the elves know, that they are, that almost no one else is aware of. So that takes an element from Pathfinder that we get to play with in a very different way.
So yeah. When you were developing Starfinder and the Pact Worlds, was the gap always an original concept to divorce the two, Pathfinder and Starfinder, or was that something that came out as you were working through it?
It came out near the beginning. There was talks at the beginning of whether or not, I mean, we had distant worlds. That was kind of an obvious thing, is when we take the planets and move them forward to the future. But there was talk about, should we do a completely different setting and completely divorce it? We ended up thinking, it's like, well, we created all this really cool stuff that doesn't really get played a lot officially in Pathfinder, because we focus on Galarian. So we did that, and we're like, well, how do we, if we're playing in the future of our other setting, how can we separate those so the two don't intertwine? And then from that came the gap.
There were a lot of other things we discussed, but super, super early, we definitely wanted to make some sort of distinction between the two time frames and the two game systems even. And the gap was the clear winner within weeks of us beginning to discuss it. So pretty much as everything else was developed, the gap was always there in the background.
And I think we were also very concerned about wanting to make sure that people who were playing Pathfinder and were having these long-standing campaigns and had all of these world-affecting things happen, you know, and we're building our canon for Galarian as well, that we wanted to not invalidate that. And so we came up with, I think the gap was probably the leading solution from the beginning, but we came up with all sorts of brainstorms about how can we build a campaign setting that is connected and is informed by that history, but that none of those things could be considered moot, or, you know, the decisions have already been made because nobody actually remembers what happened, so you're not going to find in the history books necessarily exactly what some of that stuff really was, and it's not really going to be relevant in this setting because of the gap and just like the long time period between the two.
And even in the core rulebook, we say Galarian is missing, not Galarian is destroyed. Mm-hmm. Galarian's out there.
Yeah.
Where out there is and why no one can get back and forth is part of the mystery, but Galarian is a place that exists where things are still happening.
It's probably considered sort of just this rare, ancient, old place that people may have heard of in their history books, but that, you know, isn't necessarily an active part of the setting in Starfinder.
Naturally, it's both the gap, which is just in terms of history in general, and then the disappearance of Galarian are the two big things that separate the two settings and allow them, you know, allow us to tell the stories we want to in both.
We had a question back here.
So, Pathfinder had a huge selection of gods. One of my favorite apps, I haven't actually referenced yet, and maybe Triaxis specifically, but are the other guys going to be documented, or have they just faded into obsolescence?
Well, if you think about when Pathfinder started, there were 20 gods presented at the beginning, and then over the past 10 to 12 years or something, more and more gods have been added. So we started with the core 20. We wanted to have some ones that were familiar to people at Pathfinder that kind of made the transition, and then some new ones because we have lots of new alien races. But we have said, with the exception of a few that we've called out, that like Torag, for example, has vanished. We've said the other gods are still around.
Sheldon is just on a walkabout and not answering calls, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. So, but it, the other gods still exist. They're just not as big. You know, Cain Kalian works better in the sort of, I'm going to get drunk and go into a dungeon. If you're going to fly a starship, that can lead to problems. So maybe he's not better as he used to be, but there's still probably people that worship Cain Kalian. So we didn't want to, because they're the gods, that's an interesting thing with like Galarian being gone and the gap. One of the things that's really mostly the same between the two settings is the Great Beyond, the gods and the planes. The outer planes and the inner planes, all those planes still exist. They're the same planes. You know, the plane of water is still the plane of water between Pathfinder and Starfinder. So the gods are still there. It's just on other worlds, they may be worshipped more by different people. They're just not as big where Galarian was now.
So when we're looking, and Rod did a lot of work on the court, 20 deities, right? So like, Phrasm is the goddess of death. Death remains important no matter who you are, where you are. We were very clear in Pathfinder that Phrasm is the goddess of death. Even like, you know, the dwarven god of death works to get the souls of the dwarven dead to her for judgment. So obviously she's going to make the court 20. A lot of the Galarian gods are very, very tied to Galarian. So some of them, they could transition. Iomedae becomes the inheritor of the tradition of all of Galarian. So she has made that transition. There probably are still people that worship Cain Kalian and a lot of the other gods. Lashupo has remained relevant because the Isoki have spread throughout the system and she's sort of their patron. Since we made a big deal of the fact that Torag's missing, that means that if gods actually totally disappeared, we would probably call that out for you. When we will get to the huge number of gods that are in, and when you look at Intersea Gods and Intersea Faiths and the Dragon Empire Primers, there's a lot of deities there. And Starfinder does not interact with gods in as direct a game mechanical fashion as Pathfinder did. So it is not as relevant that we give you the exact, like, domains aren't a thing, right? So we don't have to worry about the domain of every single god. We can just tell you roughly what their concerns are. And then you can, as a role-playing thing, say, well, I'm going to take the priest theme, and I will worship this god. And that means you can very easily take the deity information from Pathfinder, if that's the deity you want, and still use that for your character just fine. There's no game mechanical piece missing. We did do some stuff with the Core 20 in Pact Worlds. There's a feat that gives you a special ability if you worship one of those deities. And we did 20 because that's already 20 entries in a single feat. We might well do more of those at some point if it's appropriate, but that's just a matter of what we'll get to and when we'll get to.
Specifically, your question about Triaxis and Inasu and Devana, for that matter, have always sort of been deities in Pathfinder that have been very disconnected from their worshippers, and so have lived in their realms and have sort of been doing their own things, and they don't necessarily have like a bunch of proselytizers running around. So while on that planet, there probably are a lot of dragons who are still worshipping Yautsu, worshipping Tahak, believe in that same creation mythology that's very specific to dragonkind. There's not going to be a bunch of people who are going to go off-world trying to spread that religion. It's a very kind of internal thing for them. So they haven't gone anywhere, they haven't disappeared or anything, unless Rob says they have. but yeah, they're like these guys were saying, they're going to be sort of lesser importance on the galactic scale than those core deities are that are in the world.
We have to do sort of a balancing act too in terms of like bringing things from Pathfinder into Starfinder, because if all we're doing is repackaging old stuff, we'd be like, well, I can already read about all these gods and Intersea Gods. So we do want, when we do present that, we want to present how have these gods changed. Owen mentioned Iomedae, who is the inheritor of Eridan in Pathfinder. Now with the disappearance of Galarian, she's considered the spirit of Galarian and the patron of humanity, because she's the one big god who was a human who became a god. So her role kind of shifted a bit. But then, you know, there's new races and new gods that we also want to focus on. So it's kind of like, well, always kind of balancing what's the best thing, or what nostalgia with new stuff, I guess, is what we're trying to mix together. Yeah, we're here.
Moving forward, are you going to start integrating more legacy races into the core Starfinder setting, such as Dampfir, Kitsune, that sort of thing?
That again, I think, speaks to the sort of balancing act. I mean, in terms of a lot of those things, we, particularly the legacy races that are in the core rulebook, okay, well, these all existed on Galarian and in the solar system before. We wanted to put them in the game, but of course, this is a new game with its own races and stuff that we want to talk about. There are some things I don't know if we're going to bring. I mean, what, we have six bestiaries in Pathfinder now, plus things like the advanced race guide. That's like a whole bunch of stuff, and we have to make new stuff as well. I think some things will continue to trickle in. We don't have like a list of this is like the big thing. There's a few of those that we picked up that like a couple people like. I definitely want to make sure we bring these in.
Yeah, when we were looking at the strategy for the rules content we were including for the first year or two of the game's existence, we were really wanting to make sure that we focused on sort of a Mos Eisley Cantina feel and providing a lot of stats for a bunch of different playable aliens that you could play anything that you could really imagine. So that's why in Alien Archive you see all sorts of player character, you know, like race traits and ways to play these kind of creatures that we're presenting. So we're really focused on that, and then I think as the game progresses along its timeline and as it becomes older, you'll probably see a few more of some of those legacy things pulled in, but we really want to make sure that we are presenting a game that is a whole bunch of really cool aliens that you can play as player characters and make it feel like it's this really wide-spanning, diverse galaxy of creatures.
And one of the things that we wrestle with is, of course, most of the things in Pathfinder are stuff that was either native to or primarily on Galarian. Mm-hmm. So, like, for the things that were the core races in Pathfinder, in case you're really excited to play an elf in Starfinder because that was one of our core races, we wanted to make those available. But if you're talking about a centaur, if centaurs were unique to Galarian, and we don't necessarily even know that they were unique to Galarian, they might have been in a broader range.
I'll be on Earth.
Well, yeah, since Earth is a thing, right, that's another thing of note. We would want to think about how, in what way does it make sense to bring that race over to a game that is not focused on that world anymore, right? We want to spend at least some time telling you what races are on the other planets and in the other solar systems and in other parts of the galaxy, so that if what you're interested in when you come to Starfinder is stuff that isn't in Pathfinder, you get some of that. In the first Alien Archive, we did the Noir, which is a form of Minotaur that goes back to something I wrote in the Guide to Absalom more than a decade ago. That was a way to say, okay, here's a thing, and it is related to the stuff from Pathfinder, and so you can see that at least one subspecies of Minotaur has made it to space. That doesn't necessarily mean that we won't discuss other Minotaurs later, but we have now introduced that idea, and I think we're going to continue to look at what are the good mix, what makes sense, what do we have ideas for presenting you the updated information, right? If we're going to present hobgoblins, we want to tell you what are hobgoblins, this militaristic, organized, lawful evil race doing in space, not just here are stats and they all survived the fall of Galarian and you'll find them wherever you find anything else. So some of that is how much support can we give each idea when we're putting it forward, and as Rob said, balance.
We've also tried to, we've talked about that Starfinder is conceptually compatible with Pathfinder, so it's always something that while the rules are different, they're still built on the same basic engine. So, you know, if a GM or a player really wants something from Pathfinder, there'll need to be some conversion, whether it's a bestiary monster or a playable race, it's doable. And so for your campaigns, if you want to bring in, you know, a Dampier or a Kitsune or anything like that, you can do that with your GM's permission and everything, because the galaxy is huge and there's room for lots of stuff. It's just, we also want to show off lots of new stuff as well.
So speaking of the cantina, I have three mini questions. First of all, are there something I've always wondered is there's the red-skinned Akatonian humans. Are we ever going to get any more information about them other than they're kind of like humans, but from Akaton?
They are humans.
Yeah,
they just have red skin.
when we talk about Akaton, we are talking about those humans. But game mechanically, they are identical to Pathfinder humans. Therefore identical to Starfinder humans.
Secondly, basically same question in the Pack Worlds. There's a throwaway sentence that's like, apparently there can be half Riforians, half elves. Are we going to get any more on that? Because apparently elves are really xenophobic now, so it's weird that they'd go out and have kids with Riforians.
Well, the elves as a culture are very xenophobic. Right. There's always individuals that are different. I don't know if we have plans, unless one of you has, for something that specific. Well, some of those things we put in, you know,
It's really interesting.
Yeah, for either people to take for their campaigns and do something with, or, you know, down the line, we can also like, oh, that'd be cool, we should do something with that. But
and then the third
is like a single piece of art, please.
And then the third question is, who came up with the Bantrids? Because they are awesome.
Was
Was it Keeley?
So the Bantrids were a group effort. Keeley wrote them up. The name is based off a name I had come up with for something else.
No, I named them.
Right, but there was that was inspired by a name I had.
Okay. They were originally named something else.
Right.
We changed the name of them.
And riffed it. I had listed four names for a different race.
Okay.
And they were originally inspired by a conversation when we were sitting around and looking at Barlow's Guide to Extraterrestrials, which has a wheeled species in it. And we were like, that's fascinating and weird. We should do something like that. So
my friends and I basically decided that if you ever put one of those, if one of them ever got power armor proficiency, they would become a from Doctor Who.
Right? It certainly could. One of the things that people keep asking are things like, how does a Barother wear powered armor? And the answer is, however it wants to. We give you rules that say, hey, it takes about this long and this much money to modify your armor for some different form, and then we assume that it all works. So I would say that Keeley gets the credit for all the cool, specific descriptions about Bantrids. He wrote them up. Rod put together that specific name. We were inspired by classic science fiction from a long time ago, which frequently is something we're going back to when we're saying, what do we want in this sort of space opera mixed with fantasy universe?
And I'm playing one in our office campaign.
And he's playing one in our office campaign.
They're cool. Does he like going fast?
Always in motion. I have a wheelchair, so I'm always wheeling around. They make fun of me a lot. They say I look like a nose. That's fine, but...
Looks like a node can't smell.
Yeah. Back there.
Speaking of aliens, so are Skittermanders really that innocently, annoyingly helpful? Or a cultural strategy to keep bigger and more technologically advanced species from seriously trying to control them?
I'm not sure that's an either or question.
They certainly think they're very helpful, and they certainly think that they're invaluable on a spaceship, right?
Now, whether there's like a ruling council of Skittermanders that has adopted this as a strategy for the that's a secret. That's the secret of the Skittermanders panel that's happening next year.
I always liked the idea that the Vesk showed up on their planet, walked up to a Skittermander, and said, "We are conquering you." The Skittermanders looked around. Great, we'll help. The Vesk are blinking, trying to figure out why the species is helping itself be conquered. The Skittermanders are running around, going, "All right, we're all ruled by Vesk now. We're all ruled by Vesk now. Hey, we're going to save you some effort. We'll organize ourselves. We'll rule ourselves. We'll run our own governments. You've conquered us." The Vesk are like, "Okay." Should we shoot you some? Really not necessary. We have it handled. We're totally conquered. Good job. Move on. So I think it probably is, just realistically, that is an evolutionary urge that they have developed, because anytime anyone came along, it was like, I am the six-armed, small, fuzzy Sauron. Great, you're in charge. Good. Wonderful. Oh, you accidentally destroyed yourself with your ring. That's so sad. But now we have this government we set up while we were working for you, and...
Can we get back to building Steve's house?
Yeah, exactly. So it all grew out of sort of barn-raising community thinking, right? So I think probably that is actually their attitude, developed as a survival strategy, because the Skittermanders that tried to conquer the universe through evil and tyranny all got killed. So it's the helpful ones that have survived.
Also, if you're interested in more Skittermander stuff, in the current Pathfinder comic, Spiral of Bones, there's a backup Starfinder story, which is all about Skittermanders and interacting with the Starfinder iconics, including Obaziah. So you can actually read about what happens with a Vesk, who's left the Vescarium, who's confronted with a bunch of Skittermanders. So that could be fun to check out.
I strongly suspect, although I don't know it, it's going to be, oh God, I thought I got away from you guys.
I love that the Skittermanders do all the bureaucracy for the Vesk.
Yeah.
They're just trying to be helpful.
Which means they make all the decisions for the empire that has conquered them. So who conquered here?
How about here?
Speaking of bureaucracy, on the Packworlds, so there's the Packworlds as a political construct, and you have members, and you have protectorates,
yep.
Like the Sun, which is administered jointly, I think, and the Dreamer, which are administered by the Barathu, and Karzai the King, which is administered by its own himself. what sort of like spaces are there to tell sort of more like politically nitty-gritty back council dealings and how that sort of system works narratively for the inner, you know, we're all friends here, but kind of interaction between the pilots. And then is there a list anywhere that says like the members are X, the protectors are Y?
Because on my computer, there is a list.
Yeah, I'll get you my email.
we try in the Pack Worlds book to not with the list, sure. But in terms of calling out the places that were protectorates, and within the Pack Worlds itself, if you're looking at the major planets, if it doesn't say it's a protectorate, it is a full member. Now, that doesn't incorporate every single moon of Bretha and Liavara. It doesn't incorporate every, the diaspora itself is a protectorate, but every little asteroid in the diaspora, I'm sure some of those people are like, we're a freehold, you can't, nobody rules us, you know? And so there's not any kind of like other list than that, like some of the Chrono Wiki at some point.
Sure.
But,
I personally view the Pact Worlds as being very similar, kind of specifically to NATO. Mm-hmm. That is a military alliance that works together, that has certain rules that all NATO members are expected to follow. And in this case, NATO has some rules about how they interact with each other. But each nation is still an independent nation. So those rules are, okay, broadly speaking, we're not going to allow slavery. We're not going to allow the export of deadly viruses to other planets. You're not allowed to attack other members. And you got to put this much money towards defense, and you got to cover your sector of space. And if someone attacks one of us, they attack all of us. But each nation is still independently ruled, and the protectorates are ruled, again, at that high level. You've got to follow these high-level things. And then who the protectorate that runs them has a lot to do with it, right? The moons around Brethida, the Brethidans are very much determining what the rules are there. But that may also mean that there's individual moons who are like, well, they're not even space capable. We kind of don't care what they do. So we just make a note, you know, we're controlling who lands there, what they're allowed to do, and other than that, they're developing. So it's a very loose coalition at the individual law level. But also, of course, there is the Pact Council, which means you have that opportunity for all of that political intrigue where, like, we're going to pass a new rule that we're going to have a new set of penalties on slavery, we're going to on piracy, and we're going to double piracy patrols. And then there are some people who are thinking, well, I get a lot of smuggled goods to our planet through piracy. I don't think that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. And so you've got, even at the Pact Council, even though they are all allies, they still have their individual goals and best purposes, and real politics means that they are not always working towards a common good in a small scale, even though they all know there really is the threat of the swarm out there. It almost wiped out the system. We really can't weaken our defenses to a point where we will be overtaken. So there are tiers of control, and the Pact Worlds is only at that top tier of what threatens the entire system.
There's a lot of concern about appearances as well, of making sure that it appears that this planet or another or a moon is following the rules of the Pact, where that might not necessarily be on a granular basis the case everywhere. I think EOX is probably one of our best examples of that, where they've got the Corpse Fleet, which is this kind of rogue, roving navy that still believes in the superiority of the dead, and they, in many ways, don't agree with EOX being from the Pact Worlds. I think they should be ruling the Pact Worlds. And so there's a bureaucracy set up on EOX specifically to prove that they're following the rules, that they're not allying with the Corpse Fleet, that they're, you know, requiring their citizens to report, yeah, all this stuff. And some of it is kind of a sham, and we've been able to play a little bit with, like, exactly what that looks like and what those offices are like in the different cities, especially in Orphis.
And even then, right, on Pact Worlds, or on EOX, there's a Pact line that is sort of the safe zone for the living, and the vast majority of non-Eoxians that go to Eox stay in this one little area of the planet, which is protected and monitored and follows the rules very, very clearly. And if you get permission to go from there off to one of the rifts, perhaps, you are now moving further and further and further from being able to depend on the Pact to keep you safe, because there are roving bands of ghouls and other undead. And if you find something that some necrovite thinks he doesn't want you to find, they'll just report it was very, very sad. We told them it was dangerous. They were all killed by Elikoth. Here's a couple of bloody boots to prove that they're gone. So again, there are tiers of all of these things. And it's not like there is a single unified government that controls everything all the way down to the dog catcher and the mailman level.
The portal on Absalom Station. Are we ever going to know what's on the other side?
Ever going to know? I never say never. I don't know. Do you have any ideas about what the...
I do have ideas.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
So that is one of those things. There's sort of tiers of secrets, right? Like, you, chances are the Pathfinder folks are never going to tell you what killed Aridin and how that all came about. That's a major secret. Then there are things that maybe someday we'll do an adventure path, and the point of the adventure path will be to reveal that thing. I personally consider that to be in that second category, that we're not going to just throw it into a source book. That is a fascinating thing, and if we're going to reveal it, we're going to want to use it. And we're still pretty early in doing things like our adventure paths, right? We sort of want to tell some of the baseline sort of... We haven't even had an adventure path for everything we've declared was a major threat in the core rulebook yet. So we're going to go through that stuff first, most likely. And then as we think of other stories, we'll put them in there. I think that's on the table as something that could make for a fascinating... be that adventure path, or if at some point we're at the point where we're doing, you know, big standalone 120-page adventures or something, if we get there. It's in our Rolodex of cool stuff we might pull out. But there's not currently a plan that says, on this date with this thing, we're going to reveal this secret.
Because we also want to provide tools for GMs that are inspired by something. I know it can be a problem for people that want to, you know, follow canon all the way, because we want to put out really cool stuff that gets people inspired, and then it also inspires us, but we can't plan out everything to the greatest extent. You know, could be a year down the line, all of people are like, I've got this great idea, and it's from this one line in this thing that like all of us forgot about, and it was like, oh yeah, that would be great, but it was not like there was a plan for that. So we also don't want people to like shy away from using things that we kind of dropped in there. You know, if it's major, we spent a lot of space on it. If we just kind of talk about something, we're probably not going to get to that for quite a while, if ever.
The point of a lot of our campaign setting materials is to provide a very fertile environment for GMs to be able to come up with their own stories. And so that's why you see so many sort of open-ended plot hooks in books like The Pact World and in some of the articles that are in the Pathfinder of the Adventure Paths that, you know, we may pick up some of those. Like Rob's saying, that we don't even know what we're going to pick up a lot of times, you know, looking further out. But that stuff is all for you to really kind of play with and use as a jumping off. So, you know, never rule anything out, but also don't be afraid to pick up something that you find is cool and build off of that, because that's really what we designed that to do.
Yeah, in Pathfinder, we did an adventure path that deals with tackling the world wound, but that's an adventure path. So if you did a different story with the world wound, you can just not run that adventure path and you're fine. But that allows us to, in cases like that, say, here's a cool thing. Here's one specific story we want to tell with it. That doesn't mean you have to tell the same story. And we do our best to not, in canon, like, blow up a moon or have the Pact Worlds get merged with the Vescarium and now we've got to draw a new solar system. And if you've been doing anything different, it's all ruined. We try to avoid that.
Yeah, we also do our best not to assume that there's any one particular outcome to something that's been published, whether it's a module in Pathfinder or an adventure path for Starfinder. We try to... you know, not have like a roving sort of timeline of what you decide happens at the end of the adventure path, to leave room for the decisions that your PCs have made, maybe the way that the campaign has gone off the rails and you've, you know, rerouted as the GM or basic game so that the world still kind of makes sense without some of those like very specific events having been decided.
Yep.
I know this is more of an armory question. Sorry. Where do you guys draw inspiration for cybernetics or genetic modification that open up options for players?
Wow, like everywhere. I mean,
yeah,
it's a really cool thing. I think with that, I mean, science fiction, movies, books, anime, all those different kind of things. I think one of the things by doing a science fantasy game with Starfinder, we can also look to Pathfinder and other fantasy type things, and in the Dead Sun's adventure path, I think in your volume in Splintered Worlds, we introduced necrographs, which was like, you know, undead, basically cybernetics, but minus the cyber. You know, that would not be something that is would normally be found probably in just a core or a hard sci-fi setting. But so it's like, okay, well, what kind of interesting spin can we do with that? That led to necrographs, I think also in armory. We also have Magitech augmentations too, which is okay, now we're blending magic and technology together, which is again something that I haven't seen much of.
It's huge in Final Fantasy.
Okay.
I don't do Final Fantasy. But it is not the Final Fantasy version of that, so.
Yeah, I mean, I still have my dog-eared copy of the novel Cyborg, which the $6 Million Man was based on. And my not quite as dog-eared copy of the Samurai Street catalog. So I have, I have an interest in implants and augmentations and cybernetics going way, way, way back. That said, we want to provide enough of those things that players who want to really be involved with that can. We've done some archetypes that talk about being augmented, and we've got some stuff like that in the armory. At the same time, we don't want a player to ever look at the game and go, well, the idea of chopping off my hand and replacing it with a grenade launcher creeps me out. But if I don't, my character's penalized compared to people that do. So this is not a setting where augmentation and cybernetics are assumed and required, where if you don't do this, you're going to get a penalty, which means that we want to balance how much of that material we put in compared to powered armor or spell gems or just regular grenade launchers. So there's a huge wide range of stuff we can draw from. We just, when we're inspired, we want that inspiration to be balanced with the other things people might want to run in this game.
I think when we were looking at a lot of the big subsystems like cybernetics for the core rulebook, we were really looking to hit on what are big genre tropes, or what are big just classic elements of the genre that we're trying to be in, and how are we going to let people do that thing in Starfinder? And so, you know, for powered armor, there's a lot of us who were like, ooh, powered armor in the Fallout series, for example, is a really cool thing. We really want people to be able to have powered armor. You know, cybernetics, like in video games like Deus Ex and Horizon Zero Dawn, which was not out yet then, but is based on a lot of some of that old stuff. It's very, it's a very big thing, a very cool thing that you get to do as a player. How are we going to let people do sort of things like that? And looking at how those systems work narratively in those things, and using that as a way to inform sort of the design for what people will buy as reasonable for Starfinder was a really big consideration.
And of course, everybody on the team has their own influences too, not to mention our freelancers. I mean, mm-hmm. You just mentioned Fallout for powered armor. When I think of powered armor, I go back to Starship Troopers or Armor by John Stately, which me and Ellen are both big fans of. So, you know, it's like everybody has their own influences. And it was funny because there's the list of influences in the core rulebook with all these different things. It was all from the team. And then when the book came out, they're like, why wasn't this in there? And it was like, oh, have you heard of this? No, I haven't either. You know, that's why it's not there.
Because
it literally did not influence us. But now we've learned about it, and now we can provide some of those influences. So everything's very collaborative, and lots of people bring in different or inspirations from different areas.
Yeah, especially since there's been an explosion of availability of a lot of this stuff, right? So I go all the way back to, like, the reason the Lensman series is listed in that list is because I'm a big fan of the Lensman series. So that is inspired. It's the first sci-fi to have powered armor. It was invented for the Lensman series. That influences me. And then people are like, well, why don't you have Outlaw Star listed? And I'm like, never heard of Outlaw Star. Let me look this up. Oh, that looks really cool. Maybe it'll take some time and I'll watch that. But since I hadn't, we're drawing inspiration where we can. And then sometimes, honestly, some of this stuff comes around from us sitting around and going, you know, I'm playing the Starfinder character. You know, it'd be really, really neat. It'd be really, really neat if I could do X. And then just from the game, we start to evolve things that we want to put into the game. Grenades of Wonder, which are in the armory, came out of me running a game and just, I was doing it extemporaneously. And I was like, I need to give these guys some interesting loot. Here are 6 Grenades of Wonder. What do they do? Well, according to the instruction manual, anything. Pull the pin, throw the grenade, pray. That was very popular in that game, so that is now going to be in the armory. Also, he had a character with a Rod of Wonder, so he was very...
I've had multiple characters.
There you go, yes. I played with one of them, right.
Yeah.
So it's a concept that we think is fun to have that anything-could-happen mechanic that ties to the fantasy end of things, but since we are science fantasy... The one-shot grenade makes it a different kind of flavor.
I also recall that we really wanted to try to get that to the core rulebook, and because the table was so long,
yeah,
we ran out of space, and you were just so devastated that we couldn't get it in there. And it's like, no, eventually we'll get this into a hardcover book, and hopefully that made it work.
It did.
Okay.
It will be an armory. Yeah.
Well, so far, we have finished working on Alien Archive 2, basically. There's some trips and drabs, but so far for each Alien Archive, when the thought process started and people were like, what should we be in there? I always say, okay, I've got just one thing. There's one and only thing I want to get in there. And every time I say that, whoever the creative director is, because it's changed, just looked at me and gone, I don't think we need that in this book. But so far, I'm 2 for 2. They're in there. So that's another place where our inspiration can, you know, because literally Rob looked at me at one point and he said, well, I wouldn't put it in there, but you're really passionate. You're willing to write it up. Fine, I'll put it in. It's fine.
We have about 5 minutes left, so if you've got a question.
When I think about RPGs that blend fantasy and sci-fi. The other big one that's always been around for a very long time is Shadowrun. As you were developing the Starfinder setting, did you think about how to position it sort of in contrast to Shadowrun, how to kind of differentiate yourself from the whole Shadowrun, or was it that not something you think about?
I don't think specifically we were looking at that. I do think that Starfinder is a bit more towards the space opera side, because sort of the core idea is, and you don't have to do it this way, but the core idea is you're the crew of a starship exploring a weird universe. That's what we say. That doesn't mean you couldn't run like a Shadowrun-esque game, you know, a much more localized game. We did want to create a setting that allowed you to play whatever kind of sci-fi game you wanted. So if you wanted to do a gritty Magitek kind of thing, if you wanted to do a cyberpunk thing, if you wanted to do space opera, if you wanted to do hard sci-fi, might be a little bit harder, but you could do that kind of stuff. It was less about trying to not be like something where, but to allow people to play whatever kind of sci-fi game they wanted to within our setting. Some place there would be room for that.
And we very much started with the concept of, we have talked some about what's in space in Pathfinder. We have done the technology guide for Pathfinder, which is very, very popular. There are people that like putting this technology in their Pathfinder game. What if we wrote a game that was a lot like Pathfinder, but had a lot more sci-fi stuff and rules for Starship Combat and all of that? I always kept sort of an eye on where we were similar and dissimilar to Shadowrun, and where we were similar and dissimilar to 40K, because to me those are the two big IPs that mix something like magic and other realities and demons and spirits and technology. But we never had to say to ourselves, okay, we're too close to Shadowrun here, or we're too far away, because we had a view of what we wanted to do, and it was already not either of those things. Mm-hmm. But we certainly drew inspiration from both of those things.
Yeah, we had elements of those things that we knew that we wanted to include in the game. We knew we wanted hacking to be a thing that had a pretty robust set of rules, both because hacking in a far future setting is something that should exist, but also because that is a huge part of Shadowrun, right? And just sort of like the intrigue that you can build into a game that has those kind of hacking rules in it were a thing that we really wanted to make sure that we included in Starfinder. So knowing that kind of stuff existed, I think probably definitely informed our design anyway.
And having played Shadowrun, we also wanted to make sure that the hacking rules did not require one player to play for 3 hours while everyone else sat around. And that also informed our decisions, right?
Yeah.
We could have had a more robust set of hacking rules. The more robust a rule set is, the more likely it is to take spotlight time.
Yeah.
It's the same reason why there are a lot... There is no one character who can't be good at computers. That does mean sometimes you'll have a group where 4 of the 5 players are all really good at computer use. It doesn't become a spotlight thing. That's fine, because that way it's not like if Bob doesn't show up for the game tonight, we can't hack through this wall. So.
Okay, yeah. One more question if we got it there. Let's take it from there.
So, a question about the drift. So, Starfinder being a sci-fi fantasy game, what was behind the decision to make the drift technologically accessible?
I'm trying to remember what was the. I mean, part of it was to play with the magic, to show that this is. To sort of separate it from the magic, because you have plane shift and everything, and if everybody can just plane shift around, then it's less of a thing. So we wanted to kind of make it more like the traditional science fiction hyperspace, and I think it even kind of grew organically. Like, I don't know if it was originally had to do with Triune, but when we came up with the concept for Triune, we were like, oh, this is perfect that this technology god did this whole technology thing, and it kind of grew from there.
I think we wanted to make sure that everybody had access to faster than light travel specifically through technology and not through magic, and we wanted that to happen post Gap so that Triune then granted that technology to people, and so that you have to have a drift engine, you have to have the technology to do it, so that we could say which societies do and do not use this sort of technology, and have it be a little bit more decided exactly how that happens. And that wizards aren't the most powerful characters ever, because they aren't the only ones who can time travel. In fact, they can't, because they need the technology.
One of the conversations I had with Sutter is that he did not want fights between starships and wooden Viking ships with wizards that had used magic to get into the trip and quarter-mile-long flying carpets. If you can get into the drift with magic, then zero-tech cultures can build a thing to get into the drift using magic, and then you have to address that. We wanted starships to be the crucial element for moving faster than light, unless you're up to the level where you're doing interplanetary teleport. And even then, it's you and a small group, not 15 tons of cargo. So that was a specific desire to to take the aesthetic we wanted and enforce it mechanically so it made sense to the people who were asking, why aren't there giant yurts of straw floating in the drift that people are using to yurt it up in interstellar travel? Yeah.
And like, I'm sorry, I gotta have a giant wooden hybrid spaceship.
And what you do in your campaign is your business, absolutely.
Because it also lets us use the magic for some, like, sort of proprietary stuff. So, you know, if everyone's using technology to go through the drift, you can have Iomidian cathedral ships that actually maybe plane shift to heaven and then plane shift back out to get somewhere. But they want to keep that to themselves because they don't want other people plane shifting into heaven to attack, to orbitally bombard, you know, Iomidae's castle or whatever. So it lets us then do some of that magical stuff and make that a much more specific thing that only a few people have access to. And can and do other things with it. Yeah. All right. Well, I think we're just about out of time.
Yep.
So we have new panel coming in. So thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you for joining us for another PaizoCon 2018 seminar recording. Special thanks to the KDCon team, including Justin Sluder, Ryan Hiller, Stephen Glicker, and the entire Roll for Combat crew. No Direction's PaizoCon coverage would not be possible without their tireless effort. To find this and other great Pathfinder podcasts, visit nodirectionpodcast.com.